I said, I'll tell you what, when I get a band together, wherever we play, I'll always include a Strauss waltz. Is that okay? She said, I'll hold you that promise, Bing. Let's shake on it. So we shook hands, and she said, don't forget my two favourites are Tales from the Vienna Woods and One Day When We Were Young. By now, the sun was beginning to go down, and the whole sky was a beautiful crimson glow. And all the lights on the promenade were reflected in the sea just like a mirror. Joyce broke the cell. We sat quiet for a while, and then she said, oh, I think it's time I'd better be gone home. Mother will be wondering where I am. So we stood up, and I said to her, yes, I forgot the time, that you're only 14. So we walked off down the road. I took her home and left her at the end of Circular Road. Oh, the weeks that flowed, life was like heaven. Was for me anyway, and I think it was for her too. We went for walks through the nunnery and up Douglas Head and along the promenade. We used to go up the playing fields up at Nobles Park, had played tennis. We went to the cinema. I remember some of the films. We saw The Great Waltz. It was a black and white film about the life of Johann Strauss. There was a Russian soprano in it, Miligis Korgis. She was supposed to be the best singer of Strauss music in the world. And the chap who played the part of Johann Strauss was named Ferdinand Gravatt. That was it, Ferdinand Gravatt. Never heard much about him after that. And we also saw the film of Me and My Girl, Lupino Lane, the original London cast. They made a film. Always remember that song, Me and My Girl. And of course everybody knew the Lambeth Walk from that film. We started to find out quite a lot about each other's family. Besides her, there was her mother and father, and little Dorothy, who I'd met. She had two brothers, Geoffrey, who was in the Royal Air Force, and Leslie, who was younger than Joyce. So, as I say, we got to know quite a lot about each other. I told her about my friends, and she said her two best friends were Mabs Kinraid. I don't know where Mabs Kinraid lived. And Jean Redding. Her family had a hotel on the promenade, the Antrim Hotel, Jean Redding. She was a pretty girl too, like Joyce. Both Mabs and Jean went to the collegiate school with her. And my friends, apart from Gary Barton and Donald Collister, was a telegraph lad named Ivor Mailer, and Len Uren, he played the piano for me when I was singing at a few places. He'd been in the church choir with me, his father was the organist. And the lad who worked in the post office with me, Eric Crellin. So things went on fine. All summer and all that winter, we got really friendly. Her father and mother in the winter time, they used to go to the cinema on a Monday and a Thursday, First House. So when they went to the cinema, I used to go up and Joyce would be looking through the window for me. Her little sister would be in bed, and I used to go in the house and sit with her and her brother Leslie. We used to chat and listen to the radio and play cards. And then the other nights I used to meet her and we went for walks. Then she told me she'd one day she would loved to go to Canada till then. She was crazy about cowboy films. I remember we went to see Jesse James with Tyrone Power in, and a favourite star was Randolph Scott. He was in all cowboy films. She used to love them, and that was her height of her ambition, was to go to Canada to live and be a nurse. Well, I couldn't get her out of my mind. Everywhere I went, I kept saying, she's too young, she's far too young for me, but I couldn't let her down in any way. And she seemed very keen on me. I started composing little songs. I used to sing for her. And I still wanted to become a theatrical and have a band. That was, I'd always fancied going on the stage and being in the entertainment business ever since I was a child. And my mother used to have the theatrical staying with us. Maybe it was that. And my brother being so good at tap dancing and singing and playing instruments. Right through the winter we went together, and all the summer of 1939. I had to go to drills with the territorials 2 nights a week. Get that up. And then came the second week of August 1939, and all the rumours of war. Would Hitler invade Poland? And if he did, would England go and help Poland? It was all there in the papers and on the radio. And then on Tuesday, the 22nd of August, I took Joyce to the Royalty Cinema to see a film, Beau Geste, about the French Foreign Legion. And we were just walking home when we met a friend of mine. He was in the territorials with me. And he said, "What do you think, Bing? The advance guard of the Terriers have been called up. They've had to report to the drill hall and make preparation in case the regiment's called up. Do you think we'll get called up?" I said, it was like a bolt out of the blue, this. I said, "No, Dennis." His name was Dennis Pease. He lived in Onken. And he had a girlfriend who worked with my sister Connie at R.C. Kane's. Poor Dennis, he got killed later on in the war, out in North Africa. I said, "No, it'll probably blow over. You wait and see." And Dennis laughed. He said, I certainly hope so. He said, "I must be going. I want to see the girlfriend and tell her." So he went off. So when he'd gone, Joyce said, "You never told me you were in the territorials, Bing." I said, "No, I didn't, Joyce. I'm sorry. I didn't think I'd ever have to. I didn't want to worry you. But don't worry, there won't be any war." She hung tight on my arm. She says, "I do hope you don't have to go away, Bing. I'd have no one to tell all my troubles to then. You're the best friend I've ever had, Bing." We've had such a good time together the last 12 months, 18 months, haven't we? "I don't want you to go away." I patted her hand and said, "It's nice to hear you say that, Joyce. I'd rather lose my right arm than lose you. See, before I met you, I was beginning to get fed up with everything. There was nothing much happening. And when I met you, it made me feel so wonderful. And I could never repay you for all the happy hours we've had together. This last 18 months I've been happier than I've ever been my whole life. She replied, so have I. I wish it'd go on like this forever. By that time, we were almost at her house, so I said, time's getting on, Joyce, you'd better be going in. So I said, you'd better go in, Joyce. So I said, can I see you tomorrow night? So she said, yes. I'll meet you outside the library tomorrow night at 6:30. So I gave her a kiss and she said good night, and then I watched her as she walked into the house. True to her promise, she was waiting at the library the following evening. So we set off and walked up to the usual spot at Douglas Head and sat down there. It was quite a breezy evening and clouds were drifting across the sky. Joy said, isn't it peaceful up here? No talk of war or fighting or anything. She said, Dad was talking about the crisis at dinner time. He says he thinks there will be a war. Wouldn't that be awful, Bing? You got so much to live for, ambition. And I know you'll make good with a band if you only get the chance. I wish I could do something to help you. She said, last night I dreamt that you had a big orchestra and you were playing at the Gaiety Theatre. And I was in a box there watching with Mabs. And you played a selection of Strauss waltzes especially for me. It was lovely, she said. Lenny was playing the piano, and when you finished, the audience, the applause was terrific. She turned around, she started to cry. So I kissed her and took her handkerchief and dried her eyes. I said, there, what are the tears for? She said, I can't help thinking about all this trouble. If war comes and you have to go away and fight, my brother Jeffrey, he'll be in it too. I wish I could go away from this place and do something. If only I were old enough to be a nurse. I squeezed her hand and said, don't worry too much, Joyce. It won't happen. And even if it did, don't worry about me or Jeff. We'll come back. And don't ever leave home. I know it's hard when you're young. You want to go away and see places and do things. Then when you get the chance, we go away and in the finish, nearly always end up back at home. Your mother would break her heart if you went away. And what about poor little Dorothy? She'd be lost without you. Oh, Joyce, wait a bit before you ever think of leaving home. She looked up and smiled. She said, okay, Bing, but it's awful hard for a girl. I often wish I had been born a boy. I would have been a sailor. I love the sea. I laughed and said, I love the sea too. I wanted to go to sea when I left school, but my mum wouldn't let me. Yeah, still, that's the way of life. Till I'm glad that you're a girl, all the same. By the way, George, I mustn't stay too late. I have to be at work at 11 o'clock. I'm on all night duty with Arthur McBainey, so do you mind if we start walking home? So I held out my hand and helped her to her feet. And arm in arm we went walking off down the road. It was still pretty light as we walked down the road towards the swing bridge. Halfway down the hill there was a photograph peddler who took photographs while you waited. So he approached and said, photographs, sir? Are you lady? Ready while you wait, only a tanner. So I took a shilling out of my pocket and said, okay, give us one each. And that was the only photograph we ever had taken together. When we arrived at Joyce's house, I said, well, Josh, I'll see you tomorrow afternoon and we'll go for a walk in the park, okay? Don't forget what I said. Don't worry, there won't be any war. I gave her a kiss and squeezed her hand and then said, I'll see you tomorrow. She said, so long, Bing. And off she went into the house. then just as she was going out, she come back and she said, "Don't ever say so long. Just say so long, we must never say goodbye." And then she turned and walked back into the house. I often thought of that after. Next day was Thursday dinner time. I'd been working all night till 6 a.m, and I just got up and had some lunch and was having a shave. And it was about 1:30, and she called me and told me dinner was ready. I come down the stairs singing, "When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you." So she said, "Come on, get your dinner. What's the matter with you?" So I start eating my dinner, so I was rushing it. So she said, "What's all the rush for?" I said, "Look, I've got a date with Joyce this afternoon." My mother said, "Why don't you bring her up to see me sometime?" So I said, "I will one of these days. And then you can see her for yourself and see what a nice girl she is." He got up and switched on the radio to listen to some dance music. I just switched the radio on and the front door bell rang. My mother answered the door, and then she called, "Arthur, you wanted at the door." So when I went, there was a man standing there with a letter. He said, "You've got to sign for it." So I said, "What is it?" So he said, "It's your calling up papers. The regiment has been called up." I couldn't speak. The letter read, "In the present national emergency, His Majesty finds it necessary to call out the Territorial Coast Defence and AA batteries." At the bottom it said, "Report at once in full marching order to your drill hall." I took it off him and I couldn't speak. My mother said, "What is it, Arthur?" I put my arms around and I said, "Mum, I've just got me calling up papers. I've got to report at once." She put her arms around my neck and she cried like a child. She couldn't help it. I suppose with me being the youngest of the family, I was like the pet. I went upstairs and put the uniform on and got me kit all together and come downstairs. My mother was still crying her eyes out. I told her, "I'm sorry, Mum, I can't help it, I've got to go." I said, "Don't worry, it's just that we're being called up. Hitler will back out, there won't be a war, don't worry." I said, I'll have to report now, but I'll ask if I can come home to see the family at tea time. I'll do my best, okay?" So with that, I left her and went to report to the drill hall. By the time I got there, I found I was one of the first to report. Right away, I was put to work loading lorries with stores and equipment to be taken down to the pier where there was a boat waiting to take us to some unknown destination. In ones and twos, different men were reporting all afternoon. People started to gather around the entrance to the drill hall when they'd heard the news that the regiment was being mobilised. They were standing there to see if they could see friends or relations. There were wives and friends, sweethearts and all sorts of relations. A lot of them were crying. As I was loading the lorries, I kept looking amongst the crowd, hoping I could see Joyce, but I never saw her at all. Eventually, at about 4:30, along with Arthur McVaney, the man I'd been working all night, the previous night with the post office, he was in the territories too. We asked for permission to run down to the post office and inform the postmaster about the situation. The company sergeant major, his name was Repton, he gave us 2 hours grace. So we run down to the post office and said goodbye to the blokes there and let them know what had happened. By the time I got home, all the family were there. Father and sister. Of course, they were all upset too. My father said he'd come down to the drill hall with me to see me off, but I told him no. I didn't want to say goodbye again. It was bad enough once. I said, besides, I've got someone else I want to see, to say cheerio to. By the time I left home, it was almost 6:30. So I ran down Westmoreland Road and over Circular Road to Buxton, where Joyce's house was. I stopped on the corner. I couldn't go and knock at the door, although I was always sure Joyce's mother knew that the two of us had been going about together. Her father was a rather strict father, and he wouldn't approve. I looked up at the window, thinking she might expect me and be looking out, but she wasn't there. I was just about giving the hope of seeing her when I spied a friend of mine, Ivor Naylor. He was a telegraph messenger riding along. So I called him over. I said, look here, Ivor, I've just got to try and see Joyce before I go back to the drill hall, and I can't attract her attention anyway. I can't knock at the door. I said, no, so will you do me a favour? He said, what? I'll do anything. Anything, Bing. So I said, thanks, so what I want you to do is go across and knock at the door. If Joyce answers, call me over. If her mother answers, just say you've got a telegram for Jones at Bucks Road and inquiring if she knew any Joneses nearby. Do you understand? So he straightened his cap. He said, I get you. So he replied, set off and to the door and rang the bell. From where I stood on the opposite corner, I could see ringing the bell. I saw the door open, and then Joyce appeared. Ivor turned round and gave me a wave, so I ran across the road and up to where Joyce was. So I said, thanks, Ivor, you're a pal. Ivor smiled and he said, that's okay, Bing. When you've said goodbye, you'll find me round the corner. I'll go along with you to the drill hall. So he crossed the road around the corner. When Ivor had gone, she got hold of my arm and pulled me into the hallway and pushed the door behind her. I said, I was afraid I wouldn't see you, Joyce. I'm sorry I couldn't see you this afternoon, but you see, I had my orders, I had to report. I knew you wouldn't mind. She was crying and she tried to smile. She said, I understand, Bing. I expected you would call tonight. Mum and Dad have gone down to the pictures, so I heard this afternoon about your being called up. I'm going to miss you awful, Bing. You've been like a big brother to me. I don't know what I'll do when you're gone. I'll pray every night for you. Look after yourself and come back to me. She put her head against my chest and started to sob. I stroked her hair and said, please don't cry, Joe. This isn't goodbye, remember. It's just so long. I'll be seeing you. We must never say goodbye. I'll be back soon. You wait and see. As soon as we get to our destination, I will write you a letter. And I'll address it to Ivor, and he can pass it on to you, okay? He will look out for you. I'll write every time I can, so keep smiling. I kissed her, and then took both her hands and kissed them and said, don't forget, just so long I'll be seeing you. Then I turned and walked away across the road. Before I got across the road, I heard her calling, Bing, tears, turned round and her eyes were full of tears, but I only turned once at the corner and then I waved and went round the corner. I walked back to the drill hall with Ivor Naylor. All the way back I was thinking of all the happy times that I'd known with Joyce during the last 18 months. You have to experience these feelings to understand them. Eventually I heard Ira saying, "Come on, Bing, I'll have to be getting back to the office." So I looked at him and said, "Sure, Ira, I'll write you a letter and I'll put the letter inside for Joyce. Will you see her and give them to her?" So he said, "Yes, sure, anything, Bing." He said, "You think an awful lot of her, don't you, Bing?" I said, "Yes, I'm afraid I do. I know she's only young for me to be going around with, but I just couldn't live without her." So we shook hands and Ivor set off back to the post office. I said, "Keep your eye on Joyce for me, okay? All the best." He said, look after yourself and keep dropping me a line and I'll see Joyce get your letters. Cheerio." And with that he was off. By now there was quite a big crowd outside the drill hall. And quite a number of people who knew me. And as I passed through them, they were patting us on the shoulders and on the back. By now it was past 7:30. And about 60% of the regiment had reported. Then in batches of 40 or more, we were marched down Peel Road to the boat. I was still working with the rear guard, still loading the lorries with kit bags and equipment till late at night. It'd be about 10:15 by the time we finished. Then we climbed up on top of the load and of the last lorry and set off down the road to the boat. The pier was a blaze of lights, and along the crescent-shaped promenade the fairy lights twinkled brightly, and overhead the stars, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. The stars and the moon gleamed. The sea was like a sheet of black glass, all the lights reflecting in it. The pier was a mass of people, wives, mothers, fathers, sweethearts, friends, visitors. Everybody had come to see the boys off. Amongst the crowd on the pier you could see some of the soldiers, the last ones to arrive, and their uniforms and their badges and steel mess tins all glistening in the moonlight. I stood watching the scene from the boat deck of the steamer. There was nobody come to see me off. That's the way I wanted it. I didn't want it any other way. I hate saying goodbyes, and it was better to be say goodbye at home than at the family there on the pier. Still, I kept thinking of home and facing the tomorrow. You didn't know where we'd be or what would happen. I was glad I'd told everyone not to come to the boat. I couldn't help thinking of my mother at home crying and the old fellow trying to comfort her. And Joyce lying in bed, what was she thinking about all of this that had happened? It just seemed as if the whole world and everybody in it had gone mad. Eventually the orders were given for all the last troops to get on board the ship. So these chaps all said their last goodbyes and kissed their loved ones goodbye, and one by one they all made their way up the gangway. While these goodbyes were being made, a van and a couple of cars drove slowly up through the crowd till they were abreast of the ship, and then the occupants all got out and a big cheer went up from the troops. It was the dance band that was playing at the Palais de Danse for the summer season, and the conductor was born in the Isle of Man and had gone to London and made a name as a band leader, Jack Hart. And they got their instruments out and started playing. In a few minutes, everyone was cheering and singing. South of the Border, the Beer Barrel Polka, Tipperary, and all these popular songs and wartime songs. And then the climax came when the program came to an end with the band playing and everyone singing Ellen Vannon, the song which is dear to every Manxman's heart. That was a memory that will live forever in the hearts of everyone who was there. The air was filled with hundreds of voices blending with the beautiful song. When the summer day is over and its busy cares have flown, I sit beneath the starlight with a weary heart alone. Then it rises like a vision, sparkling bright in nature's glee. My own dear Ellen Vannon, with its green hills by the sea. As the tune come to an end, the ropes were let go and the ship glided out to anchor in the bay. And there it lay at anchor beneath all the stars and surrounded by the coloured lights of the promenade. Next morning at 9 o'clock the journey commenced. The pier and the promenade was black with waving, cheering people. People waving handkerchiefs and hats, watching through tear-filled eyes as the boat grew smaller and smaller as it sped on its way out to the horizon. On board, the khaki-clad men and the boys filled the decks, the lifeboats and the riggings, watching with mixed feelings their island home fading into the mists, which seemed to be always surrounded its emerald shores. And so it was in these circumstances that the men of the 41st and 42nd batteries of the 15th Light AA Isle of Man Regiment, Royal Artillery, Territorial Army, last saw their native island in peace. The boat took us to Liverpool, where we were landed and split up into different parties. The regimental headquarters were set at the Liver buildings near the landing stage at Liverpool. And then the regiment apparently had been designated to guard the docks from the landing stage out to Gladstone Dock, which is out near Bootle. So we were spread out in parties all along the line of docks, along that line. I finished up near one of the locks into the docks at the far end at Gladstone with roughly 28 to 30 chaps, including NCOs and six officers. It was a 41 battery was stationed out that end of the docks, and 42nd battery was nearer the landing stage. Anyway, we've split up into gun parties all along the line of docks there, and they had old guns from the First World War. They were Vickers Mark II pom-pom type of guns, and when we got to the docks there was no accommodation, so we had to start sorting ourselves out the best we could. But eventually we got a wooden hut there, some wooden huts, and which we put up under the guidance of the officers. And once we got settled in, it wasn't so bad. There were quite a mixture of Japs, a few older ones who had been in the First World War. There were about four or five of them, but the rest of us were mainly youngsters from 17, 18 up to mid 40s. But it didn't take as long to get ship shape. I had some friends there. One came from a real Irish family. His father was a fishmonger, and one of his sisters had a fish and chip shop in Windsor Road. His name was Dennis O'Hare. Dennis Patrick O'Hare, that's Irish, wasn't it? Anyway, he was a good pal, and before we got called up, he'd been working as a waiter in one of the hotels on the promenade. I think it was the Alexandra Hotel where he'd been working. So it wasn't surprising when he was made cook and batman to the officers. So he asked for an assistant, and he asked me if I'd help him. So I became assistant cook, bottle washer, what have you, washing dishes. There was another chap I'd been very friendly with, Fred Hughes. He worked in a butcher shop in Castle Street before the war, before we got called up, and he was made dispatch rider for taking messages up to headquarters. We had a motorbike there, so he got that job. And the battery sergeant major was stationed there with us. His name was Klukas, a real old Manx name, Stanley Klukas. I think he had been in the First World War too. He was the battery sergeant major to the 41st Battery. So he was there with us. And I got friendly with another lad, Tommy Blower. He wasn't a very strong looking chap. Surprising he got called up. But then I'd never mentioned about my epilepsy when I went for a medical. My family had always said, don't mention it. So when I went for a medical, I'd never mentioned it. So I suppose there were other blokes similar to me. Tommy Blower didn't look very strong at all. But he was a nice lad for all that. We got quite friendly, and as I say, I'd never done any cooking. I'd watched my mother cook, but I'd never actually done practical cooking. And I don't think Dennis O'Hare had either. He'd only seen his mother at home or in the kitchens at the hotel where he worked. So the food wasn't too good to start with. But during the following days, we got more and more organised and started to change from what they used to call territorials, Saturday night soldiers, into proper soldiers or old sweats, as the saying used to be. And the guns were mounted up, and then a watch was kept. Pat and I managed to fix up a kitchen of sorts with any odd bits of things we could find in the warehouses that was quite close. Anyway, as I say, we're getting gradually sorted out. But the food wasn't in too plentiful a supply, and of course, all young lads, we were missing our mother's home cooking and that, and we started writing letters home saying we were starving and one thing or another. We should never have done that, I know that. Then about a week or so later, parcels started arriving from home. Our parents had gathered from our thought from our letters that we were absolutely on strict rations and starving, so loads of food started turning up, and I'm sure the other chaps, same as me, were sorry we would, had worried our parents like that. I remember the first time Dennis done a roast, he done a roast potatoes, roast meat and veg, and that wasn't so bad. But when it came to making gravy, he didn't have a clue. And when he'd finished making the gravy, it was almost solid. So I had to serve it on the table, and the officers looked at it. They just laughed and never said anything. So I went out and told Pat. We thought we'd be getting the sack, but everything went by, and as I say, gradually we learnt, and by writing home and finding out what to do, Pat went and bought a cookery book. We managed, but for a short time it took. And then after the first, well, hardly a week had gone by when the first mail from home arrived. Of course, that was a momentous occasion, everybody rushing to get their letters as they were handed out by the Sergeant Major. And everybody grabbed their letters and then went and found some lonely part on the dock there where they could go and sit on their own and read their letters. Looking around, you could see tears in their eyes and as they were reading. I got my first letter, and it was from Joyce. I went around the back of the cook house and sat down, and I opened it up. Started it off. "My dearest Bing, I never realised until you went away how you really felt about me. I also know that I love you with all my heart. I wish you would have kissed me goodbye. I wouldn't have cared if the whole world had seen us." I read it over and over and then put it away in my breast pocket to keep. I keep reading it over and over. As the days went by, I received more letters from Joyce and my parents. I kept writing and posting letters to Ivor Mailer and enclosing letters for Joyce. And the following week, it was Joyce's birthday. She was 15. I bought her a wristwatch. So I sent it care of Ivor, and then I received a letter from her to say that she, to thank me for it. And then the following Sunday, it was September the 3rd. And we'd all knew that the Prime Minister was going to make a speech at 11 o'clock that morning. Everybody was round the wireless listening, waiting patiently to hear what was going to happen. There was no smiles on the faces as you looked round. Nobody was smiling. You could see everybody was tense. One of them there, sitting by me, was one of the old sweats from the First World War. His name was Morgan. Everybody called him Stiffy. Stiffy Morgan, a real old soldier. I sat there watching his face. I could see he was thinking about the First World War and was wondering if it was going to happen again. You could see he was thinking about the slaughter and the killing he'd seen, and wondering whether he'd have to see the same thing again. And there was a lad there played with in Hillside Avenue, Tubby Ryan. He was just started serving his apprenticeship as a mechanic. He loved motor cars and motorbikes. He was real happy, you know. He's a real happy-go-lucky sort of a chap. I was wondering what he was thinking. Then there was Pat. he was courting a girl and was talking of getting married. In fact, he'd arranged to get married in the middle of September. You know, I was wondering what he was thinking. His girlfriend was named Kathleen. And myself, I was thinking of Ma and Pa at home and Joyce. Whether I'd ever lived to have a dance band and go on the stage as I'd dreamed about all my youth. I'd played a couple of times with a dance band at home. Bert Ralphs, the chap who had the tobacconist shop in Strand Street. I'd played with him a few times and done vocals for him singing. I always used to pick the Bing Crosby numbers. All the lads in the regiment, they all called me Bing too. Everyone had their own thoughts, you know, and it was really tense. Then 11 o'clock came. The Prime Minister came on the radio. Those words he said, nobody who was living that time will ever forget it. When he said, a state of war exists between this country and Germany. That's the last words of his speech. Everyone was tense, not a word was spoke. Gradually all got up away from where the radio was and wandered off different places where they could sit alone with their thoughts. It had happened. The war, which no one ever dreamed would happen, had just about to commence. Back home, all the parents and friends, relations of all the boys in the regiment would be hearing the same thing. What were they thinking now?